Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Here, ladies and gentlemen, is a truism of American capitalism. When profits are on the line, bygones are very much bygones. Big Oil is today's example. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 26th of July. Good to have you with us. It's been a bit more than 3 years now since the Deepwater Horizon oil spill down in the Gulf of Mexico. And just like we all knew it would, the story is still playing out. Halliburton, the big oil services company at the center of some of the lawsuits in that case, has now pleaded guilty to destroying evidence. It's going to pay a $200,000 fine, that's the maximum allowed by law, and contribute $55 million to the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. That was for a federal criminal trial. There is still a huge and complicated civil trial going on down in Louisiana involving Halliburton, BP, and Transocean, which owned the rig itself. And the funny thing is that despite all the legal bickering between them, the companies are still getting along just fine out in the oil fields. You could call them, and we will call them, petroleum industry frenemies. Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to start us off.
So BP's lawyers bill zillions of hours accusing, and Halliburton's lawyers bill zillions defending, and then the companies spend zillions more on drillers and geologists working together on the next deep water well that could just be a gusher.
It's just the nature of the business.
Barbara Shook is a Houston-based analyst at the Energy Intelligence Group.
Companies sue each other over one project while they're joint venture partners on another project.
That's because when they're not in court, which is most of the time, these oil exploration and production companies have to pick the best technical partner for any project, says S&P equity analyst Stuart Glickman.
BP is a huge company. Halliburton's a huge company. There's going to be wells drilled and completed all over the world. You know, the geophysics are really going to dictate who they hire and where.
Plus, says Barbara Shook, they're working out in the inland shale fields, or the deep ocean, where fossil fuels are ever harder to pump out of the ground. There are only a few companies big enough to play in this pond.
We're talking about waters that are 10,000 feet deep. These are very complicated projects. They require companies that have extremely strong balance sheets to handle the liabilities should another accident ever occur.
And so in spite of what's come out about the Deepwater Horizon, these companies kind of have no choice but to make nice, even if their lawyers keep fighting in court. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Most of the time when a company, especially a big high-profile company, misses the mark on profit projections, the markets beat them up a little bit, or a lot sometimes. Amazon shareholders, however, have almost been trained not to expect profits. So when the world's biggest online retailer posted an unexpected loss, shares actually got a nice pop because the company is still growing and growing and growing some more, Shannon Mullen reports.
Amazon says sales jumped 22% in the second quarter, same as the one before and the one before that. Numbers like those keep long-term investors happy, says Sean Milne, a managing director with Janney Capital Markets.
It's very difficult to find a company that's pacing towards, you know, $90 billion plus in fiscal 14, you know, growing close to 25%.
A big part of Amazon's growth these days is its cloud computing services. Kurt Woodward is senior editor at Xconomy.com.
Amazon doesn't say how much money it makes off Amazon Web Services. We don't really know how much of the internet Amazon Web Services powers, but in both cases, the numbers are presumed to be pretty big.
Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos is famous for investing big in the company's core businesses to earn customers' trust and keeping prices lower than everyone else's. That's not exactly a new strategy.
The core of it is old-fashioned, and that's exactly why it's so brilliant.
Harvard Business School professor Ben Edelman.
It's old-fashioned but forgotten. So many companies rushing to raise their prices, rushing to collect quick payoffs, and Amazon doing very much the opposite of that.
And its stock keeps rising as long as the company keeps growing. Edelman says profits don't seem to matter to Amazon shareholders so long as competitors like Walmart and Google don't cut into its core business. I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
Speaking of stocks, the major indices were ugly early on, but just did get back to even at the close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The mobile home industry is a good ways past its prime. Since its heyday about 15 years ago, sales have fallen by about 90%. The downward spiral obviously started long before the housing bust, but then the Great Recession put a whole lot of mobile home retailers out of business. Sales are starting to pick up again with a stronger economy, but there is still, as Gigi Duban reports from Birmingham, Alabama, a long way to go.
If anyone can give the mobile home industry a boost, it's the show Duck Dynasty. The backwoods reality show stars recently struck a deal with one of the big manufacturers, Clayton Homes.
What do I know about Clayton Homes? I know they're built right here in America.
And they know the difference between a house and a home.
But this is a TV show whose characters refer to themselves as redneck. And that's a stereotype the mobile home industry is trying to shake.
I have family members that, you know, think I'm in the trailer business.
That's Kirk Walker. He sells mobile homes for The Home Place in Pinson, Alabama.
And, of course, they've been in and looked and can't imagine that this is what a mobile home or manufactured home has come to.
He shows me one of the homes they have for sale.
Of course, you've got 9-foot ceilings in here with 6-inch crown throughout the house.
Walker says these houses are more energy efficient than they used to be. Inside, they look a lot like a regular home. But he says the real draw is the price. A new mobile home in 2012 was less than half the cost of a traditional new home. Walker says people are realizing that, but it's been a slow crawl toward where the market once was.
For 2012, we probably had a 20 to 25% increase over what 2010.
There are still challenges. Sherry Norris is head of the Alabama Manufactured Housing Association. She says her industry is trying to loosen federal restrictions on loans for manufactured houses.
We haven't been able to sell the homes we would like because of the strenuous regulations that have been put on financing.
Another thing dragging out the slump? A lot of people in the last few years thought, why buy a mobile home when there are cheap foreclosures?
It's still hurting us a little. There are still an influx of site-built foreclosures out there that banks are dumping, you know, at lower prices.
Linda and Walter House, a retired couple, made an offer on a foreclosed house in Adamsville, Alabama.
I wanted a brick house.
And she kept saying she didn't want no trailer house to live in. I told her, just come on and look at them anyway.
Linda House took a look and fell in love with a 4-bedroom, 3-bathroom, double wide. The couple withdrew their offer on the foreclosure. They said it would have taken thousands of dollars more to repair. They told their friends and family they opted for a mobile home instead.
Some of them thought we'd lost our mind.
3 years later, the House family has no regrets.
This is their kitchen. You have to see the kitchen.
The kitchen's the most important room in the house.
Yeah.
They've even added a garage. It holds 2 cars, 3 tractors, and as Linda House jokingly puts it, a whole bunch of junk. In Birmingham, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
I'm going to say something now that hasn't been said in 20 years. An American-made car has been named Sedan of the Year by Consumer Reports. It's the Chevy Impala, to be precise. It got 95 points out of a possible 100, and the magazine said outscored cars costing $20,000 more. That's good for GM and good for the whole domestic car industry, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports.
If someone had told Mike Wall a few years ago that Consumer Reports would rank the Chevy Impala as the top sedan...
I would not have believed them, I don't think.
Wall is an auto analyst with IHS Automotive, and his disbelief comes from the fact that the Impala is nice and all, but you're more likely to find one on a rental car lot or in a company fleet than in an actual human's garage.
The new Impala is 180 degrees different than the old Impala.
He says it may attract people who might otherwise buy a Lexus or a Jaguar, and it's 5 to 10 grand cheaper.
The design of the vehicle is much fresher. Gone is the hard plastic. You're talking much more of a soft touch feel, leather feel.
The new car is about reaching a new market. Fleets and rental car companies buy in bulk and get discounts. But if you can sell to individuals...
That's where the real margins lie, pushing that retail button as much as possible.
Pulling ahead of Lexus and Audi is more than just a win for Chevrolet, says Carl Brower. He's an analyst with Kelley Blue Book.
The domestics have really come back from where they were, which was kind of on the brink, to be honest.
He says American carmakers' near-death experience 4 years ago pushed them to innovate. GM especially has introduced more new models than any other brand.
And what we're seeing now is really the fruit of the last 2-3 years of labor that they've put into rebuilding their product lineups.
The Impala gets just 22 miles to the gallon, but its new owners can now get plenty of mileage out of their new bragging rights. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Coming up, when the economic going gets tough, you know the rest.
We just replaced cash with physical labor.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 3 points on this Friday. That's a fraction of 1%, ended at 15,558. The NASDAQ gained 7 points, 0.25%, 3613. The S&P 500 bumped up 1 point. That's a 0.1%, finished at 1691. For the week that was, the Dow up 0.1%. The NASDAQ climbed 0.7%. The S&P 500 was pretty much flat. Expedia said bon voyage to 27% today. More customers are making excursions to other online travel outlets, apparently. Told you about Amazon. It's up nearly 3% today. Halliburton, yes, up as well, 3.7%. Okay, here comes your Marketplace Friday quiz. Which company makes Sharpie pens and Graco car seats? Answer, Newell Rubbermaid. Of course, profits are down. Stock 2, nearly 0.5%. Tyco International lost 1.5% today. Earnings slowed, partly because Tyco spun off its home security company, ADT, last fall. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note dipped to 2.56%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Monday. The National Association of Realtors releases its monthly pending home sales index. World Series champs, the San Francisco Giants, are feted at the White House. And 55 years ago, President Eisenhower helped us get closer to space, the final frontier, when he signed the National Aeronautics and Space Act of 1958, establishing NASA. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This has been a week of presidential speeches on the economy, criminal charges against a big hedge fund, and more hubbub about who's going to run the Fed when Ben Bernanke is done. I'd say that's enough for 4, maybe even 4.5 minutes of live radio. Heidi Moore from The Guardian and John Carney from CNBC are in our studios in New York City. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
So let's see. Where do we start? I guess we're going to start with SAC Capital, Heidi, and these criminal charges that the Department of Justice brought yesterday against that entire firm. Please make me believe it's different this time and this just won't be solved with them paying $1 billion and going away.
That's a tall order.
I know.
I can only comfort you by saying that they may end up paying less than $1 billion.
Really?
So, yes. So all they have to do is forfeit any ill-gotten gains, but they probably won't shut down. And the money may not be all that much. And furthermore, since the founder of the firm, Steve Cohen, owns 60%, he can still run his own business really without needing a lot of money from outside investors.
John, go ahead.
I'm going to disagree. I don't think SAC Capital survives this at all.
It's the whole stigma thing, right?
I think it's not just a stigma. It's also I think that they are going to try to take a lot more than $1 billion. I think they're going to try to say that all of Steve Cohen's money has been commingled with ill-gotten gains and all of it can get taken away. I think we will see one of the largest forfeitures in American history coming down, billions of dollars. Deficit relief, I guess.
Yeah, John, we should figure out where that money goes. Wait, Heidi, I want quickly though, because there's lots of other stuff to get to. Is Wall Street writ large worried about SAC Capital going away? Is it like a systemic thing?
You know, SAC is really important to Wall Street. It's a $14 billion hedge fund. It's incredibly profitable. And a lot of other firms have their trading caught up with it. And so I don't think that they do want to see SAC go away, even if they accept that it has to be punished. Another issue with it is that, you know, SAC, you know, Steve Cohen is going to be incredibly powerful whatever he does. So even if he's not at SAC, they really don't want to alienate, you know, the person who's essentially the godfather of Wall Street, which is his position.
He also has paid tons and tons of fees to the big investment banks. Yeah. I mean, when you run a hedge fund of that size, there's people who live entirely inside of Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, whose job it is to just serve SAC Capital.
But exactly. do you think even given all this, I mean, people are still going to be willing to be seen with this guy having lunch or whatever?
You know, money can buy you a lot of friends in this world. And as long as he's got the money, he's going to have the friends.
All right. Let's move on. The president, as you guys know, made a bunch of speeches this week, 3, I think, total about the economy and his plans for the fall and all this. Heidi, please make me care. Make me believe that this isn't just politicking and that's it.
Well, I think it's a good fight for President Obama to pick right now because we are going into a huge economic season where this is going to matter. We're ahead of the 2014 elections. The economy is the most pressing issue facing America right now. And something like 60% of Americans think we're still in a recession.
Yeah,
and the recession ended in 2009. So it's a good fight to pick. The question is, what's his strategy for actually winning this time? And he didn't play any cards on that front. He just kind of complained about Republicans and bragged about health care, all of which is great. But which won't help him get an economic plan through. He and his administration need to really buckle down and come up with specific
ideas. It's also just not clear that he has a real economic plan other than, we're going to keep doing what we're doing and I'm going to make some speeches about it.
So how does this play out then, John, in the fall when we're talking debt limit fight again and government funding and all that stuff we've been dealing with for, years now?
I am going to make a bold prediction and say I think the Republicans are tired of their debt limit fight. It hasn't been
– I think you're dreaming, John.
I don't think it's been
dreaming.
Doing very well for them. So I think we're going to have a different tone when it comes to the debt limit. I don't think that's going to be the showdown this time.
All right. Fair enough. Quickly, before we go, Heidi Moore, who do you like for chairperson of the Federal Reserve, Larry Summers or Janet Yellen?
I think Larry Summers will make for better stories because he fights with everyone.
Yes.
But Janet Yellen has a lot more support within the Fed, and she has that academic approach that we like in our Fed governors.
John, who do you like? But also explain to me why it matters, because whoever gets this job isn't going to turn around and raise the federal funds rate on day 2.
Right. It's not going to be a sudden shift. But look, Larry Summers is much more skeptical about quantitative easing than Janet Yellen is. So we'd probably see that get pulled back much quicker. I think Larry Summers has the inside edge because he's got Obama's ear. He talks to Obama even now that he's no longer officially in the administration and he's taking down big fees from Wall Street banks. He is he still talks to Barack Obama on a semi-regular basis, and Janet Yellen does not have that relationship.
All right. We're going to see how this one plays out, John. I don't think you're right, but whatever. Anyway, Heidi Moore and John Carney. We'll see you guys.
What a surprise.
I know, right? Have a good weekend, you guys. We'll see you.
You too. Thanks, Kai.
Bye,
Kai.
Bye-bye.
Summertime is the season of outdoor concerts and music tours. And for musicians, the idea of hitting the road and making new fans is pretty much their equivalent of the American dream. But the reality for most musicians is that going on tour is a money pit. You're lucky to break even, if that. Some bands, though, have discovered a new frontier where they can actually make decent money on the road. Alex Lewis reports now from Anchorage, Alaska.
Alameda is an indie band based in Portland, Oregon. They've been together for 4 years now, and they're fairly popular in the Portland music scene, regularly playing the city's bigger venues. And yet they still barely break even on their tours out of town. So this summer, they decided to try something new.
What attracted me to Alaska was kind of in the sense of going somewhere that I have no frame of reference to.
That's Sterling Miles, the frontman and songwriter of Alameda.
It's part of the United States, but it's something different, and I feel like it's in a strange way, like an exotic place to go.
So how did Alameda find out about touring in Alaska?
My name's Evan Phillips, and I run the Monolith Agency, which is a small boutique booking agency in Anchorage, Alaska.
With Monolith's help, Alameda was able to secure guarantees that range from $300 to $600 per show to play in venues, dive bars, public parks, and even houses. Evan and his partner started Monolith 4 years ago, and they've already brought a bunch of groups up to Alaska. He says the good pay for bands is simply a matter of supply and demand.
The cool thing about Alaska is that it's not nearly as saturated with bands or musicians.
And unlike other places, touring Alaska isn't just about playing music. It's also about experiencing the landscape.
I think what we're doing is really cool because we're essentially giving bands an opportunity to come up here and have a paid vacation.
Here's Alameda frontman Sterling Miles.
So you get to really explore. So like, you know, when we were in Seward, Alaska, we played a set and the next day climbed a mountain. And then the next night played another set.
Evan Phillips says an Alaskan tour isn't for everyone. You'll be contending with long nights and sometimes drunken hecklers. But Sterling Miles says it's worth it.
You can definitely make a chunk of change while being out there, but it was more about the experience surrounding the shows. It's more about you have to enjoy the day as well as the night.
And during the Alaskan summer, those days stretch out for more than 20 hours. In Anchorage, I'm Alex Lewis for Marketplace.
...2005 was arguably an economically better time. The housing market had not yet gone bust, Europe was not yet a mess, and barely anybody out there was warning about bad things to come here. Marty Jo Link, though, was definitely not in a good place. She was freshly divorced, facing foreclosure, mounting utility bills, and she had three hungry and growing mouths to feed. So she doubled down and spent a year living off the land of her farm in northern Michigan. She tells the story of that year in her new book, Bootstrapper. Marty Jo, it's good to have you with us.
Nice to be here, Kai.
I'll tell you what. I know I didn't live this year in your life that this book is about, but I was tired by the end of this thing. This is quite a tale you tell.
You know, I think sometimes we forget how satisfying physical labor can be, how great it is to feel tired at the end of the day.
Well, and that's in large part, that's what this book is about. You, on this farm, decided right after your divorce that you had to live off the land. I mean, you were chopping wood and catching animals and all of that stuff.
We were, yeah. And I had a lot of help from my three kids. So it wasn't just me. They were my little workers. And, you know, we just replaced cash with physical labor pretty much for about 12 and a half months.
Well, explain that a little bit. I mean, just to set it up, you got divorced, it wasn't necessarily great, and you were on a farm in northern Michigan with fundamentally no money.
True, true. I was freelance editing, freelance writing. I had three kids, and I had made this promise to myself many, many years ago when I said, you know, someday when I have a family, I'm going to raise them in a rural way. And I was going to do anything I had to make that happen.
Tell the story of the zucchini squash, would you? Because that might be my favorite thing in this whole book.
I had been going to this local bakery on every Sunday morning to get their day-old bread because it was cheaper. And one morning I saw this sign that said, biggest zucchini contest, win $100 for first prize.
Tell me what $100 meant to you. I mean, that was...
That would have, you know, a loaf of bread was 50 cents. So $100 would have paid for 6 months to a year of, just sandwich bread for us. We ended up winning first and second place. And it was sort of a rare victory for that difficult year. Just being able to do something right meant a whole lot.
And then comes the day. We're about, 6 months into this year, 7 months into the year. You wind up going into school and getting the boys on the free lunch program. And that's the first time you ask for assistance.
I did. And that crossed a line that I said I would never cross. I always thought that those kind of programs were valuable, but they were for other people.
It's clear that it killed you. I mean, you list, and I'm just looking at it right here, you qualified for federal food assistance, child care and development fund, Medicaid, the home heating credit, low-income housing energy assistance program, weatherization, free venison from hunters for the hungry, rather. I mean, there's lots here that you didn't want to do.
Right. I felt like I had challenges that were of my own making, and so I didn't think that other people should have to provide for me. I felt like I needed to provide for myself. I needed to solve my own problems, and I needed to be a good role model for my kids. But signing them up for the free lunch, that was a hard one. Mm. And they were only on there for 2.5 months.
Still bugs you, clearly.
It does. Yeah, it does.
We should point out on the way out that this story does have a happy ending. You fell in love. The kids are good. You're still in the farmhouse?
Yeah, we are, yeah. And everything is just splendid. I couldn't have imagined that things would have turned out so well.
Marty Jo Link, her book, it's a memoir. It's called Bootstrapper, From Broke to Badass on a Northern Michigan Farm. It's a good read. Marty Jo, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, which comes with the observation that crude oil closed in New York this afternoon at $104.70 a barrel. The United States is, as you've heard here and elsewhere, producing more and more of its own energy nowadays, thanks in part to what's come to be called fracking, hydraulic fracturing. It's not without controversy. But we pause today to mark the passing of the man who made fracking commercially viable. George Mitchell died in Galveston, Texas today. He was 94 years old. Our Scott Tong did a story on Mr. Mitchell a little while ago. It's on our website. It's marketplace.org. And with that, we're done on a Friday. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up 3 points. That's a fraction of 1%. The NASDAQ up 7 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 up a point. We'll call that about 0.1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here on Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a good weekend. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.